It's 9:02 in the morning. Today's date is January 27, 2011. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. Today we have four bills before us. Let me first recognize we have with us Senator Pasfan, Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer. Senator Kukesh is on his way. We also have in the room President of the Senate, Gary Stevens. The first bill is Senate Bill 31 regarding the counting of write-in votes. We took the bill up on Tuesday and heard testimony from a variety of parties, all of whom spoke in favor of clarifying the state's election laws. We have a CS before us, version B, and my office has not received any proposed amendments from committee members. Mr. Hopkins, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and offer any final comments for the committee to consider? Let me just recognize that Senator Kukesh has just joined us. We just gaveled in.
Chairman Wilkowski, thank you for having me before the committee. My name is Grier Hopkins. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Joe Thomas. Thank you again for having me here today and for hearing Senate Bill 31, an act relating to the counting of write-in ballots. Senator Thomas, again, apologizes for not being able to make it, but he's currently in a Finance Committee meeting. Senate Bill 31, like we stated last on Tuesday, looks to clarify our statute by utilizing language recommended in the Miller v. Treadwell decision of the Alaska Supreme Court. The language is nearly identical to the Federal Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. This lays out explicitly how the Director of the Division of Elections will use the determination of a voter's intent as their guiding principle when counting and judging a write-in ballot's legitimacy. Senate Bill 31 follows on the heels of nearly 50 years of court findings in favor of voters' intent. The goal of Senate Bill 31, again, is twofold. The first goal is to clarify our state statute language to ensure that in future elections, as many Alaskans as possible are enfranchised. The second reason is for Senate Bill 31 to tighten our state statute and strengthen the public's perception of Alaska's democratic process. Senate Bill 31's goal of ensuring voter enfranchisement and putting into statute inclusive as opposed to exclusive language will protect the fundamental democratic rights of Alaskans and as they enter the polling booth with a wide variety of backgrounds and abilities. Thank you again, and I urge your support and passage of Senate Bill 31, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Any final questions? Okay, seeing none. The bill has another referral to the Senate Judiciary Committee. What's the will of the committee at this point? Senator Pasfan?
I move that we have the...
Do you have to close public testimony?
We've...
Is it already?
I'm sorry?
Did you have to close public testimony?
Yeah, we closed.
Procedure already?
Yeah, we closed last week. Yeah.
I move that we advance Senate Bill 31 as I think it's under the CS, and we advance it from this committee
with the individual recommendations.
And zero fiscal note.
Just for fiscal note.
Just for clarity, we're advancing the CS, which is version /B. Yeah. Is that correct, Michelle?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Any objection? Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved to the next committee.
Thank you, Chairman and members.
Okay, thank you. We'll pass around the recommendation form. Next up is Senate Bill 33.
Thank you.
The second bill, this bill will ensure that a soldier's burial wishes are honored in the event that he or she is killed in the line of duty. On Tuesday, we heard from a variety of individuals regarding this bill, including Mark Sanson, regional liaison for the Northwest Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, Mr. Verdi Bowen, Director of the Office of State Veterans Affairs for the State of Alaska, and Rick Davidge, the President of the Alaska Chapter of Vietnam Veterans of America. During the hearing, a question was raised about whether the bill applies to members of the Coast Guard, and we have a new CS in front of us pertaining to that question. I'd like to call up Michael Caulfield to come forward and very briefly put yourself on the record and explain what the new CS does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Caulfield. I'm an intern in Senator Wilkowski's office. And yes, the question was brought up if the Coast Guard was covered under this new bill. And the answer was, at the time, it was not, because the Coast Guard is a part of the Armed Services, so they come under the same federal statutes, but they are not a part of the Department of Defense, so they use a different form. So you'll actually see on the committee substitute, which is 188/D, we've added a second paragraph to Section 2, which designates the Coast Guard's form, which is the designation of beneficiaries and record of emergency data form, as the form that they will use in the event of the Coast Guard member's death.
Okay, any questions?
/D in front of us?
It is not. Could I get a motion to adopt that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we bring the CS for Senate Bill number 33, version /D as in David, before this committee.
Okay, and I'll check to see if there's any discussion among the committee. Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Is there any objection to the CS being adopted? Okay, seeing none. The bill has another referral to the Judiciary Committee, I believe. Is there a motion to move CS for Senate Bill 33, version D, from the committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note?
I so move.
Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved to the next committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Next up, we have Senate Bill 18, which is duration of regular legislative session. And Senator Stevens is here. I know he's got another engagement. Senator Stevens, would you like the opportunity to welcome to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate your putting this on the agenda. And I have with me Tim Lankin, and he's very familiar with the bill, and we're glad to explain any parts of it and the specifics of it. But let me just explain why we got here. By a vote of the public, we very close to what we went to a 90-day session from 121, and we entered it hoping that we could make it work. The problem I saw last year was that we wound up in the first year it worked fine. The second year was particularly a problem, being stuck at 90 days. We had a lot of bills to deal with, and of course, as you know, at the end of the session, all bills disappear. And so a lot of bills died that didn't have time to be fully vetted. As you know, last year we, at the end of session, we had a lot of things going on. We were trying to move things from the House to the Senate back and forth, and we went over a few minutes, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes. So the question is, were those things that happened after the 90 days been completed, were those things not legal? Did those not stand, the things we passed after the 90-day limit? And, of course, the advice we got was absolutely everything we passed was legitimate and legal and was law. So I'd just like to say, make it clear that, you know, what we do beyond 90 days is certainly acceptable in a legal term because of the Constitution. The Constitution says 121 days. So the reason I introduce this is I've never been happy with the 90-day session. I think it does stop debate. I think it does not allow the public to be fully involved. As a member of your resources committee, I remember at times you had to say people testifying on very important issues, you've got 1 minute or 2 minutes to present your case and that's all. So I think the public was shortchanged. My real concern, though, is that I think the legislature has been weakened by this process. I was talking to a former Senate president who said his goal when he served as Senate president was to leave the institution as strong as when he left as the day he entered. And that's a very good point. And I feel because of this 90-day change that we really have weakened the legislature in relationship with the governor and the administration. So the reason I introduce this is that I hope discussion will take place. I frankly am not concerned whatever amendments you may choose or any place along the way if we make changes to it. I simply propose that we go from two 90-day sessions to a 90-day and 120-day session because that was a good compromise and it takes us forward. But if you want to make it anything different than that or, you know, 60 days or 80 days or whatever you choose, I think the discussion is important. I think we need to talk about it. So I think that's the main things I wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, and Tim Lankin will be here to go into specifics and tell you why things didn't work out as we explained, tell you why. The reason that the public voted for this, the rationale that was used was it'll save money, hasn't saved money. The reason the public voted for it was that they thought we would see more people running for office if they only had to serve 90 days instead of 120 days. That hasn't been the case at all. And Tim will show you a chart that he's put together that shows that in 10 years, from 2000 to 2010, instead of the 150 people that ran for office in 2000, we're down to 100 people running for office this year. Can you believe that? We have gone from 150 running for the legislature to 100. So moving from 90 days, moving 120 days to 90 days has not increased the public involvement. And in fact, I don't know if that's the reason, but we have seen a strong decrease. So I hope you'll look at those charts that Tim has prepared. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. President. Any questions for Senator Stevens? Okay, thank you. I know you have another engagement. You're welcome to stay as long as you like, or we understand if you have to leave. Mr. Lampkin, if you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Gary Stevens. I have a short presentation for you to sort of back up the arguments that we'd like to make. I'll start with our overall theme here is that Senate Bill 18 strikes a compromise between the vote that occurred in 2006 and what's stated in the Constitution. On a side note, sorry that you have to turn around to see the presentation. I was going to recommend to Ledge Council that we put a screen back here, too, but that's another subject. So in 2006, as everyone's aware, there was ballot measure number one, which reduced the legislative session from 120 days constitutionally to 90 days statutorily. Now, as by way of history, as you'll see as the next few slides, up until 1984, there was no limit on the legislative session. The average was around 70 days or so since statehood, and we during the 80s and so forth, we crept up to in the neighborhood of 170. There was an initiative, I believe, in 1980 or 82, asking the voters, should we limit ourselves? And they said overwhelmingly yes. And so then 1984 was when they actually voted to make the limit. Since 84, then we've been under a 120-day limit, 121 legally. Of course, in 2006, we passed the ballot measure one. Notably, that was a very low turnout. And election year, for what that's worth. As you'll see in this chart, we had a spike in 1992. I didn't look as to what that question was that year. There was a constitutional amendment on the ballot, but I didn't research what exactly that was. But more significantly, you'll see that it's obviously fairly cyclic. Generally speaking, the peaks are when we have presidential elections. The valleys are when we have statewide and muni elections. You'll note, though, that in 2006, when we had the vote, there was the third lowest in several years. So nonetheless, a vote is a vote, and majority rules, so we've tried it since 2008. This will be the fourth session that we've operated under a 90-day limit since that vote took place. However, Senator Stevens, as well as I would venture to say several legislators, would feel that the interests of Alaska are not being served. And the arguments, particularly the arguments in support of passing the ballot measure, are not being proven as valid. And some of those arguments include, of course, the most compelling argument, I would venture, is the reduction in the cost of state government, particularly the legislative branch. Second argument, of course, made, and this is all derived directly from the election pamphlet, which, you know, was used to help voters decide which way to choose. The second argument made that was that 27 other states had shorter sessions than Alaska. The third argument was that legislation to shorten the session had been introduced 24 times since 1990 with no action taken. And so thus, they used the initiative process to effect that change. And then finally, the fourth point was that less time in Juneau theoretically reduces the amount of time away from home, away from family, away from your private sector work and other activities that you do during the interim, and thus would also incentivize, according to the Juneau Empire, more quality or competition, quote, between individuals to run for office. So in regard to reducing the cost of government, specifically from that pamphlet, it was stated that we save 30 days of per diem, expenses of operation of the legislature, paper copy costs, chaplain fees, travel costs, and so forth. The fact is that now that we've gathered some data since that time, that the actual session costs, the actual costs of the legislature have indeed increased. There has not been a significant savings. There's still, we don't have long-term per diem anymore, but we still have legislative salaries. Session per diem has increased. Travel expenses continue to accrue and so forth throughout the year, not just during session. So following our first 90-day session, there were indeed two 30-day back-to-back special sessions in 2008. And there's also been an increase in the traveling roadshow style joint hearings that go around the state, touring facilities and so forth, which of course are much more expensive considering travel and hotel and so forth, than having hearings here in Juneau when they come to us and do presentations like this. So here's a chart to show you some of that data. This is the number of meetings, interim committee meetings, that have occurred since 2000. And again, you'll note a pattern. It's very cyclic. The peaks are non-election years. The valleys are election years. You'll note, however, that in 2010 even. Well, first of all, 2009 was the highest in the past 10 years. But the valley for 2010 is still also the highest valley that we've had. So what the data suggests is that the shorter session has resulted in, obviously, more interim meetings that are arguably just as expensive, if not more so, had we just maintained the legislative session at 120 days. Here's another chart that I mentioned earlier about the days, the lengths of our sessions since statehood. Again, you can see a pattern here. In the early days where it started to creep up a little bit, but the 80s here, of course, are piped by the construction days where we had significant boosts up, and the public recognized that that was an unacceptable trend. Here was our constitutional amendment, and here we dropped down to 90 days. Significantly here on the bottom are special sessions, and I kept the line here to help indicate that these were successive years. This is a pattern where they were consistently back-to-back, or year after year after year, they were connected that way. And you'll see a significant spike here around the time that we limited the session. Again, indicating that basically from point number one, reduction of the cost of government, there is not a significant, if any, cost savings by maintaining a 90-day legislative session. Point number two of four is that what about all the other states and that the fact that 27 other states or a significant other had limited their sessions? Well, I looked it up, and currently, to date, there are exactly half, 25 of the states of the nations do not limit their legislatures whatsoever. Now, that isn't to say that they meet year-round. There's only a handful, five or so states that continually meet throughout the year. But the significant fact is that they don't limit themselves statutorily or by their constitution. Currently, with our current system, Alaska ranks 29th. Point being that, you know, every state has its own reasons. Every state is unique and has its own set of circumstances and chooses to operate its legislature the way it does. And Alaska is no different. We are considered perhaps as the do-it-yourself state. So my point would be that, well, who cares what other states are doing? We're pretty much in the middle of the road on this issue, and Senate Bill 18 simply moves us closer to the middle. If we do shift back to 100, we'll shift up to, say, 27th or 28th in the lineup of the other states. Point number three is that legislation was introduced 24 times since 1990 in an effort to shorten the session with no success. So, as we all know, legislation that has no likelihood of passing is introduced almost every day in the session. There are roughly 1,300 bills on average introduced every session, roughly 350 of which pass. Just the simple fact that something doesn't pass doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to go to the ballot box. The legislature, of course, has its own prerogative to act or not act on any issues. And there's lots of other issues out there that haven't been given as much attention. Now, here's a chart that doesn't read as well on the screen, but it indicates the number of bills introduced and those compared to, Alaska legislation, not just bills, but resolutions too, introduced since 1979. You see a steady trend that has decreased since that time. The point here being that even with a shorter session in 08 and so forth, there was kind of flat number of bills and resolutions introduced with, however, the same, roughly or very close to the same amount actually passed. So again, there's perennial issues, not just shorten the session, but issues such as abortion, which I looked up has been introduced 58 times since 1990. Move the Capitol, another favorite, has been introduced 28 times, again, more often than moving the Capitol, and so on and so forth. Oil, gas taxation, subsistence, coastal management, school truancy, mining taxes, so on and so forth. I didn't look those up, but the point being that they are issues that constantly approach us, and it's the reasoning of the argument of supporting ballot measure one, since it's been introduced so many times, does that imply that after a bill passes or fails to pass after X number of attempts, should it automatically be forwarded to the ballot box for a vote? Rhetorical question, but our position is that it's not really a valid argument to say that something should become law simply because it has not been passed in law a number of times. The final point, shorter session means less time away from home, away from family, work in the private sector and so forth, and therefore will incent more competition between quality individuals to run for office. Well, this graph speaks for itself. Election year 2000, we had approximately 100, we had exactly 143 candidates, and that has taken a steady decline. I bring to your attention since, most significantly, the vote in 2006 on the ballot measure one was about 126. This 2008, we took another dive, and it took a nose dive between 08 and 10. That's about a 20% reduction from 120 to 101 candidates. So point there being that since 2006, to shorten the sessions, the candidate pool has shrunken by 20%, the opposite of what was argued in favor of passing ballot measure one. So there's other considerations in conclusion. Of course, we're all familiar with the fact that public testimony has been limited severely. Constituents, fly-ins, and so forth, it's much more difficult for them to meet with us, or you, rather. It's never difficult to meet with the staff, but with the legislators and the deliberative process that the legislature exists to facilitate. And then, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't throw a kudos out to my fellow staff workers. The simple fact is that we're working harder. We're already putting in, at least I know I am, at least 10 hours a day, and it's just the beginning of session. And it's free overtime, basically. Now, that's not a complaint. We love what we do. But the fact is that the burden of this extra workload, there's the same amount of bills being passed, and it's that much less time for us to help you get the information that you need to get this legislation, this work done. And then finally, of course, I'll point out, I didn't go into detail with this, but I'd like to bring it to your attention. There was a House subcommittee through Legislative Council that I believe it was in 08 or 9, I believe, that is in your packet, which essentially concludes that strong majority of those surveyed, staff and legislators alike, at least in the House, did agree that it would be in the best interest of everyone involved to restore a 120-day session. And then finally, overall political theory viewpoint, which is perhaps the perspective that I'm most in favor of, is the idea that this is a balance of power issue. When we restrict the amount of time that we're spending in Juneau, it's essentially a power shift to the executive branch. The ability to meet annually with less constraint on our duration in order to keep abreast of current developments, of federal or otherwise, and to review programs and administrative activities, generally considered necessary for a legislature to be an effective policy-making body, and particularly to avoid being dominated by the executive branch. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation and would be happy to help answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Tim. Interesting presentation. Senator Myers, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Tim, for that presentation. And as the President said, he wants to generate some discussion. So I'm going to start that discussion. And first of all, I need to let you know that I'm very biased on this issue, biased in the sense that I do have a family back home that I'd rather see in 90 days versus 120 days. And also I have a bias because I take very seriously what the voters voted for and what they said. You know, and they said they wanted to limit us to 90 days, albeit it was a very close election. You're absolutely right. It's 52% or something like that. But I'm just wondering if we even need to do this, because we already know we can go over the 90 days legally, because the Constitution says up to 120. So we did it just last session. So knowing that, do we even need to, you know, make this formal change?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. First of all, it was a vote of 50.8% to 49.2. If the legislature would like to ignore the statutes, it certainly has the right to do that. And we do have the ability to call, you know, extend the session once by 10 days, but to make the effect legal, I would recommend that we would make this change. Again, it's a compromise. It's a 90-day first session and a 120-day second, so that would be the only change. It would strike a balance.
Okay. And if I may continue? And you brought up the fact, too, that we are paid a per diem, and obviously right now we're paid per diem to be here for 90 days, which then, and this is going to go over like a lead balloon, begs the question, you know, why don't we have meetings on Saturdays, since we're paid, actually Saturday and Sunday, to be here. And again, I coming from a biased position, I'd just assume be here, work 7 days a week, get the work done, go home in 90 days. And I don't know how other states do. I don't know if they meet on Saturdays, but I think as we get towards the end of session, certainly we meet 7 days a week. And I think as we get towards the end of the session, some committees actually meet on Saturdays as well. But I don't see any reason why we couldn't be meeting on Saturdays even now. Have we looked at how other states, if they go just 5 days like we do, or if they go 7 or 6?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I have not made that query, but I certainly can. I have the data handy, not on me though. I would imagine, my intuition would be that those states, I believe it's Alabama and Wyoming, that meet 90 days every other year, or some even actually less than that. I believe it's 40 days, 40 and 40, for example. I would look at those first to see if that's something that they do, because the number of issues out in the universe it is big. It's a big number, and so they're certainly dealing with the same types of issues that we are generally. It's a good question, and I'll be happy to look it up. As far as meeting on the weekends and Saturdays, though, for us, none of us are superhuman. I mean, that's a lot of work. It can be done. It's part of the dialogue that's up to you to decide.
Okay, very good. And then, if I may, just one more question, Mr. Chairman. On your graph here that you provided, and I appreciate that, the one that lists the number of days biannually that each state meets, a lot of times I know we like to compare ourselves to other states of similar population. And if you do that and you look at, for example, Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana, they're way on the other end there, much less than we meet. But I also know you could probably make the argument that we are a newer state, we have more issues, we have more things to deal with. Obviously, oil and gas issues are very complex. But I just wanted to make that note that when we do compare Alaska with other states, we like to use Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana as examples, and that doesn't really help the case in this particular instance. But thank you for your presentation, and as the President says, you know, this is worth discussion, and I'm sure everyone here has got a different opinion on the number of days we should be meeting. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Other questions? Senator Passman.
I would just make the comment, you know, my thoughts on this are evolving. Certainly before I had to come down here, my opinion was that 90 days must be more than enough time to do what we need to be doing. Once I arrived, then my thoughts on that started changing to the point that, for example, in looking into the operations of government, looking into how we make each department operate, you know, the thought that came to my mind is all we are just hitting the top. We're not getting into the substance of what we really need to be doing to make sure we are providing the citizens with efficient government. And, you know, where we need to concentrate the people, the state employees, so that they can better accomplish what needs to be accomplished. You know, we are hearing now about permits. We're hearing now about economic policy, and where do we need to focus the state's employment. So, those are policy choices that the legislature has to make. And if we're just hitting the tops of these departments, then maybe we're not doing our jobs, and we may be limited in that regard because of the 90-day limit. Again, I think one of the more serious questions that's raised is the constitutional obligation as a policy deliberative body, and I think that we cannot ever allow that to be ignored, that we are that policy body. And I think that when it comes to that inquiry, 90 days for a young state is very dicey. I think we can do it. I think the people that are putting together the budgets and the more fundamental tax issues that are addressing this state, I don't know that 90 days is adequate time other than just barely touching the surface of any of that. So I guess I'm open to the inquiry and the debate.
All right. Yes, Senator Kukesh.
Thank you. I just want to thank the gentleman for the presentation. I had a lot of questions, and I really appreciate the information. It answered a lot of my questions for me. I have to admit I'm biased, too. My bias is that I want 120 days on both sessions. And I've been in the legislature long enough to know that I've left a lot of people at the doorstep in my office because we don't have time to see them, and even my staff don't have time to see them. And when I ran for legislature, I committed myself to the legislature, and 90 days is just, as far as I'm concerned, not enough time. And I like the idea of a compromise of 90 days on a first session and 120 on a second. Never thought about it before, but I like it. Makes sense to me, and I appreciate the information. If I had to vote today, I'd vote for this bill to go forward. Of course, we're not at that position yet, but I think my bias is going to, no matter what I hear from now on, I think my bias is going to be continue to support a 120-day session. I appreciate the information. It helped me settle a lot of questions in my mind. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Yes, Senator Giesel.
Tim, thank you for the presentation. Can you help me understand why there's a zero fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative Giesel, correct?
Correct.
Sorry, thank you. The Legislative Affairs Agency is probably the best suited, I believe Ms. Barney is present in the audience, to speak to their fiscal note, but essentially, the money is there in our existing budget that is being held for anticipated special sessions. And so that's why it's basically the message is that we can absorb the extra cost, session costs, in our existing budget. That's the bottom line. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Thank you.
If you have want to drill down deeper, we can, and I'll call on Pam.
We get, if there are no other questions for Tim, let's get Ms. Pam Varney and Shane. Or Shane, are you the one to talk about this? Or come on up, Pam.
Yes.
And let me recognize that Senator Menard has joined us. You're welcome to join us up front if you'd like. Okay. Could you please put yourself on the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, my name is Pam Varney. I'm Executive Director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. When the fiscal note was done back in 2006, we decided to not look at eliminating the funds out of session expenses, not knowing how this was going to work for the legislature. And if you look at the last couple of 30-day special sessions where we spent over $800,000 and over $900,000, we set aside $800,000 in the session expenses component for special sessions. In the past, when we've had special sessions, we've had to ask for a supplemental, and sometimes, as you know, that takes a while for that to happen. And so we felt we could do this cost shifting instead of having the money designated for special session, that we would then transfer it back into personal services to pay for those 30 days and the per diem expenses too for the regular session. So that's why there is a zero fiscal note. What would happen is if we did not have sufficient funds in the session expenses component, if this passed, we did the cost shift and we had a special session or a couple special sessions that were 30 days long, then we would have to ask for a supplemental. But we naturally try and fund the special session from existing operating funds that we have in the legislative budget.
questions for Ms. Varney. Did you have other testimony you wanted to give?
No, I'm just here to answer questions and really about the fiscal note. So,
yeah, Tim.
Tim Lampkin, just in follow-up to that, it could be a good point to make, too, from a policy-making standpoint, that the fact that we would need to call on a supplemental budget is something that would be part of the decision to call a special session, and so there wouldn't be, theoretically, it wouldn't be a whimsically made special sessions called. It could be an incentive not to make too many special sessions. Thank you.
And for what it's worth, I'll just throw this out there. The special sessions that we've had a special session on ACES, we had a special session on AGEA. Do you think we would have, I don't know that we would have had been able to complete those during a regular session. Do you have any thoughts on those, on that?
I agree with you.
I mean, even if we were going 120 days, I just think that they consumed so much of the, there were really 30 full days of legislature being involved in hearings on that, and I just don't know. I don't know whether if we had 120 days, we would have done it in that time frame or not.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's anybody's guess, but I would venture to say that with a 120 day session, I think that the special session would have been shorter, because there would have been some time allocated, at least some more time during the regular session to those issues, at least theoretically.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. We have Shane Miller here. Shane, did you have anything you wanted to add just for questions? Okay. Okay, well, I'll open it up for public testimony. Do we have anyone in the room wanting to testify? See no one. Do we have anyone online? No. Kind of shocked we don't have anyone wanting to testify. I'm going to hold over public testimony at this point. And we'll, Tim, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, sir. Thank
yeah,
you.
Let's. I think this is a complex issue. It's. I think it's one that we probably want to mull over for some time. I don't know. I want to give the public an opportunity to weigh in. I think there are pros and cons to this bill, and I just want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to digest it, the public has an opportunity to digest it and get us their comments. I don't know that people really had an opportunity to weigh in on this. I mean, certainly noticed and everything, but I know this is one of the topics that I hear a lot back from when I'm in Anchorage and I hear from my constituents. I know I did get one letter which we passed around to the committee from someone. But I think I'm going to hold the public testimony open at this time, and we'll revisit this bill in the future. Is there any other discussion? Okay, well, let's set this bill aside for now, and then let's move on to Senate Bill 26. Thanks, Tim. And I'd like to call up the bill sponsor, Senator McGuire, or her office. Welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. Through the chair, my name is Genevieve Watusik. I am an aide for Senator McGuire. Please excuse her absence today. She is upstairs in Senate Finance right now, so I'm going to testify for her, if that's okay. And also on the line, we have Whitney Brewster from DMV and Daniel Frakes from General Motors for any technical questions. Senate Bill 26 is an act exempting vehicles fueled solely by alternative fuels, motor vehicle registration fees and taxes, and providing for an effective date. Senate Bill 26 is a progressive approach in presenting incentives to the public for utilizing vehicles which employ the new technology of alternative fuels. Other benefits of this bill include helping air quality and the potential for job increases with the new technology of products. The automotive industry has been undergoing a significant transformation by moving toward the electrification of the automobile. Providing incentives would encourage many stakeholders and consumers to move forward with necessary changes, accelerate the deployment of second and third generations of the technology, and achieve economies of scale more quickly. all leading to reductions in the cost of this new technology. The availability of plug-in vehicles will be expanding, and we need to prepare Alaskans to be the first frontier for this advanced technology, and this bill readily supports its introduction. So this bill shows that Alaska is welcoming advanced technology and is itself getting itself plug-in ready. And we do have a CS in front of you as well.
If you could walk us through the do I have a motion to adopt the CS?
I would move that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill 26 version /B.
Okay, and I'll object and for discussion purposes, and if you could walk us through this change.
Okay, I'll walk you through the changes. Is that okay?
Yes,
what
please.
We changed. So we changed in the title, vehicles fueled solely by electricity or compressed natural gas, to vehicles fueled solely by alternative fuels. And then there's a definition on page 2 that says all the ones we are accepting, and that's compressed natural gas, liquefied natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, hydrogen, a liquid at least 85% of the total volume of which consists of ethanol, and electricity. And then on page 1, starting at line 8, just the qualifications of the vehicle: must be manufactured for use on public roads, must not have been modified from the original manufacturer, must be capable of achieving speeds of at least 55 miles per hour, and must be acquired from the manufacturer on or after October 1st of 2010.
Okay, thank you. The fiscal note, it's $20,000.
Yes.
How much is a registration fee typically, and what is it doesn't appear that there's any accounting for the loss in registration fees.
It goes to municipalities. Not every municipality receives these. It's up to the municipalities, but I believe Whitney Brewster is on the line, and she could probably answer that more thoroughly.
Okay. Ms. Brewster, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am here.
Okay, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, and I'm the director for the Division of Motor Vehicles. Currently, just to speak to the fiscal note, we did request $20,000 for programming to modify the DMV's database to be able to capture information regarding fuel type. We currently do not capture that information. And so there would be some modifications required, and that is what is reflected in the $20,000 figure. What we were not able to determine is what the loss of revenue will be to the state, because we do not capture that information. We do not capture fuel type, as I said. So we do not know how many of these vehicles are out there with this specific definition of fuel type for exemption. And so we believe that it will likely be small, but as vehicles fueled by these methods gain popularity, there will be likely a proportionate decrease in revenues. And that is the registration amount. And to speak to the cost of a registration, a biennial passenger vehicle registration is $100. But beyond that, the DMV, as Genevieve stated, the DMV does collect motor vehicle registration tax on behalf of local municipalities. And right now we have 16 that we collect for. We collect those fees, and those are passed along to the municipalities. And it's my understanding under this bill that vehicles that meet the definition of this bill would be exempted from paying those motor vehicle registration taxes as well. So we do retain 8% of the motor vehicle registration tax for administering that program on behalf of the municipalities, but the rest of those fees do go to the municipalities. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you have.
Maybe if you could help me out a little bit. So the state collects a $100 registration fee, and then there are 16 municipalities that collect an additional registration fee. Is that how I understand it?
Through the chair, or I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, it is not the exact amount. The local municipalities set the amount of the tax through ordinance. Whatever they choose to collect, that is what we collect on their behalf. They forward those ordinances to us, and that the amount set forth in the ordinance is what we collect and pass along to them.
So the state doesn't collect. So that $100 you were talking about, what was that?
The $100, Mr. Chairman, the $100 registration fee is strictly the registration fee, and 100% of that goes to the general fund.
Okay. I have a 1995 Jeep. I haven't bought a new car in years, so I haven't dealt with registration fees recently. Any questions from the committee? Yeah, Senator Pastrana.
Yes. If there were a sales tax that a community imposed, does DMV collect the sales tax, and would it be subject to this?
Through the chair, Senator Pascan, it's my understanding that a sales tax would not be included under this bill. The DMV does not currently collect sales tax on vehicles on behalf of the municipalities.
So, again, kind of following up with Senator Wilikowski's, you know, understanding of the tax that the municipalities impose, are these just flat fee taxes as compared to sales tax that would be on a, you know, dependent upon the purchase price of the vehicle as compared to just every vehicle gets a fee, so to speak, or a set amount?
Through the chair, Senator Pascan, the municipalities base their ordinances typically, I think every time, actually, with the exception of Juneau, they set those fees based on the year of the vehicle. And so we collect the $100 registration fee, and depending upon that goes to the general fund, but depending upon the area in which the individual resides, we collect the motor vehicle registration tax based on the year of that vehicle, which then goes to the municipality. Now, there are lots of communities that do not have a motor vehicle registration tax, and in those cases, we would simply collect the $100, and those fees would then go to the general fund.
Yes, Senator Passman.
Is it the intent that, as you understand it, of this legislation to prohibit the municipality from imposing their revenue? In other words, or is it just DMV isn't going to collect it, but the municipality can?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, I can only speak to what the DMV would do, and I can state that the DMV would not collect the motor vehicle registration tax on behalf of the municipality under this bill for these particular vehicles.
Thank you.
Does the department have a position on this bill, Ms. Brewster?
Mr. Chairman, we have no objection to the bill.
Do you support the bill, or you're just neutral on it?
Mr. Chairman, we're neutral.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Brewster? Okay, seeing none. My staff has reminded me that I need to remove my objection to the CS and decide whether or not we want to object that. Is there any further objection to the CS? Okay, seeing none, the CS is adopted. It's before us. Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess my question would be why not include like the hybrid cars? But I think you're reading what is covered, like compressed natural gas, liquefied natural gas, hydrogen, ethanol. I guess the intent here is to get off of any gasoline whatsoever.
Sure, a hybrid could be added to this.
Hybrid could.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that, if I understand a hybrid, I don't have a hybrid, but I understand they still are part gasoline and then part battery.
Yes, I believe that is true.
Okay.
But we have someone on the line from GM who would probably know better than I would about that as well.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, and I just, I think it's a good idea. I don't know how this would impact, like, some of the rural areas that don't have this capability, you know, for these type of vehicles yet, but as they gain in popularity, I'm sure they will.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, just I think from my perspective, I'd like to get a little better handle on how this works, that if we could identify the 16 communities that would be affected. Yeah. I'd like to know the whether or not there's support from those communities, if this is going to be a big loss to the municipalities, for instance. I'd just like to have some kind of a handle. I know there aren't a huge number of electric vehicles out there, but I think certainly the communities across Alaska would be interested in figuring out what their loss, potential loss, is going to be. I know I certainly would be. Other questions by the committee? Yes, Senator Pasfran.
Just following up on Senator Myers, you know, do we know how many vehicles are currently hybrid as a?
Yes, the DMV did provide that through the chair. Right now, there's 1,563 Ford Fusions. There's two types of Ford Fusions. It's the same model, but one is a hybrid and one is not, so it's impossible for the DMV to tell right now. And then there's 600 Toyota Priuses, and Priuses aren't included at the moment in this bill, but they could be. And then the Nissan Leafs, we have none of those yet in Alaska that are registered, and that's it for right now.
So just kind of, if we were to pass this just with the vehicles that are on the road today, that would result in a loss of over $200,000 in revenues to the state.
This bill is...
assuming a hybrid was included.
Sure, through the chair. But it's cars bought after October 1, 2010, so it wouldn't be that high of a number yet.
And just for...
Bought too soon.
Just for clarity purposes, is this the registration fee when you buy the car, or is this the biannual registration fee every couple of years?
Biannual.
Okay. So someone who bought it on the day before we passed this bill, or the day it goes, they have to pay their registration fee indefinitely, whereas someone who buys it the next day doesn't have to pay that indefinitely.
Yes, Chairman.
Okay. And do we have any sense on how many, I'm assuming there are very few cars that are running on, that would be eligible for this right now?
We don't have a number yet because there's no way for the DMV to track it, Chairman.
Any sense at all? Are there any?
Maybe Whitney could answer that. I'm not sure.
Ms. Brewster, do you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, the vehicles that meet the definition in the CS, I am not aware of any. However, any vehicles currently registered that meet this specific definition, but again, I'm speculating because the DMV, again, has no way of really doing a search of its database. We could pull makes and models that we know meet the definition of this. We could do that and try to get a sense of how many of those vehicles exist. But as Genevieve indicated, she did give some numbers of those that are hybrids. But really, we would need a list of all of the vehicles that would meet the specific definition and do a search of each of those vehicles within the DMV's database.
Yeah, I'd just like to get a handle on, I think this is a good bill. I think this is you know, the idea of moving off fossil fuels and getting people onto electric cars and alternative, I think is a fantastic idea, something that we promoted in previous legislation. I just want to get a handle on what we're getting ourselves into economically, how much it's going to cost us, and do the cost-benefit analysis, how much it'll cost the communities also, I think is important. So any other questions before we move on? Okay, let's open it up to public testimony. We have Dan Franks. Ms. Franks, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. First, I'd like to thank the State Affairs Committee for this opportunity to testify on behalf of General Motors. My name is Dan Frakes, for the record. I'm the manager of Advanced Technology Policies and Vehicle Fuels for North America, as well as I sit on a board with other colleagues to talk about these same issues globally. GM is in support of Senate Bill 26, and I'd like to provide some supporting information. At the end of each of the following slides, I will ask if there are any questions before I proceed. In your handout deck, slide number 2.
And so hybrid, and if you could just hold on, the committee's grabbing the handouts. It is, yeah. Everyone have a copy of this? Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Franks. If you could go ahead.
Yes, on slide number 2, hybrid and plug-in tax incentives have proven to play a key role in the development and acceptance of advanced technology vehicles. As with any new technology, the first generation tends to be expensive, and consumers may be tentative towards something new or unfamiliar to them. So incentives help overcome this anxiety. Once subsequent generations are developed, volumes tend to increase, economies of scale take effect, and incentives can be phased out. The types of incentives that we've seen for these vehicles range from incentives towards the purchase price of the vehicle, waivers for state income tax, license and registration fee exemptions, as was mentioned just earlier, infrastructure incentives for both the charging equipment as well as installation of this equipment, HOV lane access, and free parking in public lots. Just some couple items on why GM would support Senate Bill 26. Any questions on this slide?
I don't see any. So if I'm looking at this chart, it looks like there are only three states in the country that don't have either a private or government incentive.
Currently, yes. And this takes into account hybrids as well as electric vehicles.
Okay.
So the hybrid tax incentives and hybrid vehicles have been around longer than the electric vehicles. So that's probably the bulk of the population on this graphic.
Okay, I don't see any questions on this. If you could go to the next slide.
Okay. Slide number three. Quickly, I will provide some information on our latest advanced technology vehicle, the Chevrolet Volt. It was launched in December of 2010 to select markets around the United States. It was expected to have our national rollout in 12 to 18 months from December of last year. GM and we announced today at the Washington, D.C. Auto Show that this vehicle will be available nationally by the end of this year, ahead of our original schedule. The Chevrolet Volt is the first mass-produced electric vehicle with an extended range. It will provide the customer 25 to 50 miles of gas-free, tailpipe, emissions-free driving, and this range covers about 85% of drivers who commute to and from work on a daily basis. The vehicle also has a total range of up to 379 miles. It's powered by a 16-kilowatt lithium-ion battery pack. It has an extended range, which is achieved via an onboard generator, which keeps the batteries at their minimum required state of charge. You can also charge the Volt through one of two ways, either the standard 120-volt cord set, which you can plug into any household outlet. Charge time is about 10 hours using this charging means, or we have the optional 240-volt charger, which can charge the car in about 4 hours. Any questions on this slide?
All right. I don't see any.
Okay. Slide number four, just to show that the industry is moving quickly towards plug-in vehicles, I've put a few examples here of other manufacturers that have electric vehicles or plug-ins in the market now or will be within the next year, and you can see there's a variety of manufacturers available. Any questions there?
Okay.
Next. Okay, slide five. Talking about CNG, compressed natural gas infrastructure in the United States continues to increase. CNG offers low cost, abundant, and it works towards the country's goal of energy independence. GM is launching a new dedicated CNG product this year, and GM supports incentives towards these types of vehicles as well. Any questions?
I don't see any.
Okay. Last slide, slide six. In summary, the electrification of the vehicle is here. Incentives on the federal, state, and local level are a win-win across the board. It helps a customer adapt to this new technology, It helps our country, states, and cities get plug-in ready and helps lower the cost to the industry and moves towards these next generations of technology. There's no silver bullet going forward in terms of technologies. In the near future, we will see several technologies available for transportation, including electric vehicles, CNG vehicles, hybrids, and fuel cells. So in closing, GM supports Senate Bill 26. I thank you again for this opportunity to testify and would take any final questions.
All right, thank you. Senator Passavant has a question.
What my you mentioned phase out of the plans in other states, and I was wondering what the phase out criteria is that might be applicable to this Senate bill. Is it as a percentage of the vehicle population, or what other criteria for phase out have you seen nationally?
Nationally, we've seen programs that benefit hybrids and electrics starting to phase out in the 2014 or 15 time frame. And it's just looking at by that time, economies of scale, new technologies are starting to come out. Next generations of products are going to come out. So we would focus and intend to see costs to start to decrease.
Senator Myers, a question.
Yes. Thank you for the presentation. Just two quick questions. And I think one was you sort of addressed previously, but typically we do the incentives for these hybrid alternative type cars because the cars themselves tend to cost more than a car that is run just off of fossil fuel. Can you give us an example for like on this Volt, how much more that would cost versus the same car if it was just sold on regular fuel?
Okay. For example, general hybrid systems, not an electric vehicle hybrid like the Chevrolet Volt, are about $3,000 to $4,000 above a comparably equipped vehicle. For the Chevrolet Volt, the base price of this car is $41,000. With the federal incentive that's out there available for the vehicle right now, it takes it down to about $33,000. And then a comparable, like a Chevrolet Cruze, which is comparable in size, is in the mid-20s.
Okay. Thank you for that information. And also, as I mentioned earlier, I don't have a hybrid, but I heard some concerns, and it might just be the initial concerns of anything new, that for example, a hybrid and the batteries don't hold up real well in cold weather. And I was just wondering, I'm sure you've done testing in extreme cold weather. For example, my friend here from Fairbanks, where it's minus 35 degrees. How do these electric cars work in climate like that?
Well, definitely temperature, both hot and cold, extreme hot and cold temperatures do affect the batteries. And that's why for the electric range, we say 25 to 50, and that depends on how you're driving the vehicle and where you're driving the vehicle. So that's why we give that range. With the battery pack on the Chevrolet Volt, we do offer a 10-year warranty on it. So we are, you know, making sure that the customer is comfortable with that and, you know, would be able to have a very long warranty period to help them get over that hurdle of something new.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just on that point, I have an iPhone and I've had it for a couple of years and the battery life is not much at all now, but I mean, is it a similar problem with the cars? Does the range diminish pretty significantly as the years go by? And is that something that would be covered by the warranty?
Yes. Just one thing on the other point, the battery is controlled by temperature of the vehicle, it has a heating and cooling system that runs through the battery to help keep it at a constant temperature. But yes, as a battery is used, its life changes a little bit, so that's why we do have this warranty period for customers that would have any problems with it, but we don't expect to at this point. And the battery warranty, I misspoke it, it is 8 years, it's not 10 years, I'm sorry.
And then I'm looking at your backup, and one of the things that I see here is that there's an insurance discount, which is offered in 47 states, except West Virginia, Hawaii, and Alaska. And I guess that's a private incentive, but I'm just curious, do you know why that's not offered in Alaska?
I do not know. I can try to find out some information and help provide that back to this committee.
Sure, that'd be helpful if you could provide that to my office. Thank you. Okay, other questions for Mr. Franks? Okay, really appreciate your testimony. Very, very helpful. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify? Okay, hearing none. Is there anyone else in the room wanting to testify? I have Stacy Oates on the list. Stacy, did you want to testify? Okay, Stacy's no longer there. She was from DMV, it looks like. Okay, with that, I'll close public testimony. Is there anybody else online? No? Okay, seeing no one. Public testimony is closed. Okay, any other committee discussion at this point? Okay, we're going to hold the bill over. If there are any proposed amendments, if you could provide them to Michelle, my staffer, by Monday at noon, that'd be great. If seeing nothing else come before the committee, with that, we're adjourned.